I can't think of an animal I know less about than the manatee. When I heard that today's guest was a manatee expert, I had to Google it to see what a manatee looked like. But in fairness to me, I live nowhere near the kind of habitat that manatees require for survival. So maybe what's surprising isn't so much my own state of ignorance, although I feel bad about that, as our guest's expertise. He grew up in Independence, Missouri, and he went to school at UMKC. Probably not a lot of manatees around for him either, but life took him in some unexpected directions that led him to found the Save the Manatee Club in the 1980s. And he must be doing something right because manatees were taken off the endangered species list in 2017. We're going to hear that story now on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, Patrick Rose. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please forgive my ignorance. Can you tell me about the manatee and why it needs saving?
Well, manatees are a large marine mammal. They can inhabit freshwater, estuarine, and even the marine habitat, as it might suggest. But they're a very docile animal. They can weigh up to 3,000-some pounds. They normally would weigh about 1,000 pounds, but they're just not even capable of being aggressive. They're vegetarian. And so when they're going about their daily life, man has done a lot of things to their environment to put them in danger. This last year in 2018, more than 122 manatees were killed by watercraft collisions alone. Red tide ended up killing some almost 300 manatees. We had many die from cold stress, and just the pollution problems with their environment are actually getting worse, even though we've done a lot of good work over the last 40-some years to recover them. They're no way out of risk at this point.
You know, they sound just incredibly sweet, like that they are not capable of being aggressive and they're vegetarians. Like, they're giant. You know, they're large mammals, right?
That's right.
And vegetarian. Is that an unusual pairing?
It is somewhat unusual. They have a living relative in the dugong, and they have an extinct living relative, the stellar sea cow, which got even larger, up to 30 feet long.
What is an extinct living relative?
Well, pardon me. It's taxonomically they're related within the same order, Sirenia.
Gotcha.
But that particular species did go extinct in just about 27 years because they were the ultimate docile animal. They wouldn't even run from the fur traders who were eating them in the Bering Sea areas. So it shows you just how quick man can extirpate an entire species.
Oh, how did you get interested in manatees?
Well, I grew up, as you mentioned, in Independence. I played in every creek, pond, and lake that I could, got in trouble constantly. Being 10th of 11 children, we kind of had our ability to roam the woods and so forth, and I just loved water and everything water. As early as the fourth grade, I read in Weekly Reader about manatees and was fascinated.
Do you remember what fascinated you as a fourth grader, like some factoid?
Well, the first thing was they called them sea cows then, and I thought, well, a cow that's in the sea, that's underwater, that's strange, that's interesting. Then learning a little more about them, and again, my love of water, I became a scuba diver, ultimately began teaching scuba, and in fact, we formed a dive club here at UMKC during my college time.
That's so cool. I mean, you do have to admit, though, it's not the most obvious thing on the surface for a Midwestern kid to grow up to be an expert in a marine creature. When did you kind of have this, like, light bulb go on over your head, like, okay, I love the water. I want to study this. Like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to study sea life.
Well, in my love of diving, we made very many trips, especially in spring breaks, to Florida. And during that time, in the wintertime, the manatees congregate at warm water areas such as natural springs, which stay 72 degrees year-round. And so I made it my mission to find them and to learn about them. The first encounter was literally in some pretty murky water. And the first thing I saw were the scars because they're lighter than the animal's body color. And so immediately see that. Then you're you sort of take your breath away because they're so large. And then underwater, everything looks a third larger than it is. So
really?
It's pretty dramatic. And then you wonder, well, they say they're docile, but are they really? And so, you know, but you get past that quickly because you build that affinity towards them. And you realize it's man is their only enemy. And if we can help them, if we can hurt them, then we can also help them.
Yeah, we could transform ourselves into friends.
Yes.
What would that look like to you, a friendship with the manatee?
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing. Now that we've done so much over the years, we've done a pretty good job of building affinity. Sometimes people want to love them too much, and so they want to be with them, pet them, or, you know, in some wild cases, try to ride them, things like that. So what we're trying to do is build a respectful affinity that can give people a chance to love them and get to know them, but not cause them to change their behavior or hurt them.
I'm curious about the sort of juncture in your career where you founded the Save the Manatee Club.
Well, let me kind of fixed that a little bit. It was Jimmy Buffett and Governor Graham of the governor of Florida really who got together with the concept to start Save the Manatee Committee. Since I was doing research with manatees and so forth at that point in time, I was asked to participate as the scientific advisor to the committee. So I was one of the original founding committee members, but really the credit needs to go to Jimmy Buffett and Governor Graham.
Margaritaville Jimmy Buffett?
Yes, Margaritaville Jimmy Buffett.
I did not know that he was passionate about the manatee.
Absolutely. He's done just about everything you can imagine to help make sure that they have better lives.
What do you know about how he came to this passion that you two apparently share?
Well, Jimmy also loved the water, and he was a sailor, and you can remember some of his songs, a son of a sailor. And that's true. He really was that. Spent time on the water. He would see manatees. He also would see their scars and had developed empathy for them. And so, as I understand it, he was approached by Governor Graham backstage after a concert, and the governor introduced his two daughters to Jimmy. Jimmy took that opportunity to ask the governor, you know what, I'm concerned about manatees, and there is more, can we do more to help them? And that was the genesis of Save the Manatee Committee, which became Save the Manatee Club.
And you were the person they reached out to. Can you tell me about where you were in life at that point and what made you you were clearly passionate about this topic, but what made you at this point, the person who it would be obvious to turn to?
Well, because of the research I'd done and what I'd known about manatees and knew much more had to be done, I was working also with the legislature to get the Manatee Sanctuary Act adopted, to put forward the scientifically based information and the recommendations as to what could be done specifically to help manatees in terms of protection on the water, to prevent injuries and watercraft collisions, and to also prevent them from being pushed away from the springs and the power plant effluents which they aggregated at. So I had done a lot of work at both the scientific and political level already.
Can you describe in some more detail what you did lay out in the Manatee Sanctuary Act?
Well, to begin with, we started to primary focus on protecting manatees from being directly harmed by watercraft collisions, from being, as I said earlier, driven away from those warm water sites, which are critical to their survival. If they don't stay in that warm water during the coldest time, they can die by the thousands. And then thirdly, working also with even development projects and things like that to make sure that their adverse effects from the unsustainable aspects of growth and development in Florida could be better controlled.
So this species has gone from endangered to vulnerable. Vulnerable still does not sound good.
Well, it's technically listed as threatened, which is
threatened.
Is still a very serious classification.
That has more of an urgent sound than vulnerable.
Right. And vulnerable would be under the IUCN classifications for more of an international classification for species, which are quite important as well. The endangered and threatened are under the United States Endangered Species Act. So, and they're also protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act federally. But having protections on the books versus actually making sure those protections apply to where they live and the habitat and all the circumstances, those are the remaining challenges. Because when the Fish and Wildlife Service reclassified the manatee from endangered to threatened, they said they weren't going to change anything and the manatees would get just as much protection. That really hasn't turned out to be the case. And we've broken new records since then. The habitat is being degraded in a way that the brown tides, the blue-green algal blooms, and the loss of seagrass and those things. So despite all of our successes, we're at a point where we've got to make sure the habitat is secured or we'll lose them going forward in the long term.
I mean, those factors that you just mentioned, like the brown tide, can you explain what they are and what causes them a little bit more?
Well, it goes back to man again. And we have millions and millions of septic tanks in Florida where they developed in areas where they really shouldn't put them. They leak into the environment. That waste makes its way into the manatee's habitat in the estuaries and the rivers and so forth. Those extra nutrients build up over time. And then those in a brown tide, those organisms will bloom in by the billions and billions. And they can literally shade out the light from reaching the seagrasses. The seagrasses will subsequently die. That nutrient is released to the environment. And it just really, it sets those systems up to collapse. And those are the manatees' food sources. They're also the places where the fish are going to get their nutrients. So it affects fishermen. People on the water don't have an enjoyable time. So we're starting to reap the adverse consequences of not living our lives in Florida in a sustainable way.
You know, I mean, it's, as I listen to you, it is, I when I had looked up the manatee and done some reading about it, it seemed like such great news that it had gone from endangered to threatened. And this just doesn't sound that way anymore.
Well, we actually wrote extensively and advised the Fish and Wildlife Service that it was premature. They actually received over 100,000 comments, of which less than 50 were in favor of what they were doing. They sent out the proposal to a set of peer review scientists. None of the peer review scientists which responded supported downlisting them either. So we feel this was more political than it was scientifically based.
Why politically would anyone want to hurt the manatee? The manatee sounds so nice.
Well, they won't tell you they want to hurt the manatee, but what they want to tell you is they want less government regulation. They don't want the government their lives. And since the things you need to do to protect the manatees are the things you need to do to protect the aquatic resources, that means the development projects and are going to have more scrutiny because they're going to have adverse effects. But if the law doesn't require them to mitigate those kinds of effects, they can then build more and do more. I guess fortunately and unfortunately, it's catching up to Florida because of the problems I explained about the habitat. When you have brown tides, you have blue-green algal blooms, you have red tide, which is not caused by the pollution but is exacerbated. So those neurotoxins released by the brevetoxins released by the red tide organisms kill fish by the millions, and it makes life miserable for people living along the waterway. So in a way, it's a terrible thing, but it's also bringing attention to the failure that come along with listening to the politics of an issue instead of the science.
You know, you've had lots of sort of stunningly extraordinary moments in your career. Among them, a rescue mission when the Challenger exploded.
Yeah, we had gone to Fort Myers, Florida, to a power plant effluent with the idea that we'd be capturing manatees temporarily to fit them with radio transmitters and satellite transmitters. When we got there, there was no warm water. That's why the manatees were, you know, going to be there, and they're dependent on that warm water in the winter. And I think, as you recall, the day the Challenger blew up, it was one of the coldest days in the winter we'd had, and that's literally led to the O-ring failures. It was literally an emergency because had they continued without warm water, many manatees were likely going to die. And my action that day, sort of summarized in a succinct way, was I called my executive director of the Department of Natural Resources. I told him of the problem. He asked what we should do. I just said as clear as I could possibly do, you need to call the governor, and then you need to ask the governor to tell the president of Florida Power and Light to turn the power plant back on. Because what they had done is they'd scheduled an outage during the middle of the winter at a time when it would have caused this severe damage. Fortunately, things worked well, and that's what they did, and so that emergency was averted.
You know, you're back in town to receive this Alumni Achievement Award in Biological Sciences from your alma mater, UMKC. What are your thoughts about science education? Like, what budding young scientists need to know and how you think they should be learning it and thinking about it?
Well, you know, if I think about the difference between when I attended here in the early 70s, both as a bachelor's and master's program, and there are a difference between the two. But I think it is follow what you're interested in, learn the details about it, but even more importantly, learn how to work with people and learn how to believe in something, but don't get discouraged when it doesn't happen immediately. Be willing to put in the time and effort. And as you get that first opportunity to show what you can do, be willing to volunteer with no money.
Sounds like advice that goes beyond science.
I think so. Yeah. Your life experiences are important and that will help you follow your passion.
Patrick Rose, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Patrick is the founder and executive director of Save the Manatee Club. He's in town to receive an Alumni Achievement Award in Biological Sciences from UMKC. Up next, if you don't have the attention span to sit through an hour-long play, would 10 minutes work? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm joined by Ron Simonian. He's been teaching a playwriting class at the Living Room Theater, and his students are putting on a program of 10-minute plays that they have written during the class. I have many questions, such as who takes up playwriting in their spare time, and what can you pull off on stage in 10 minutes? Ron Simonian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So the whole, first of all, this class, like, these are adults?
Yeah, it's been adults, and it's a wide range of people, ages, men, women of all ages. It was kind of exciting to see so many people a little bit outside of the 20-year-old range starting to write plays, and they have stories to tell, and we're helping them get them up, and it's really cool.
Have people talked to you much about why the idea of a playwriting class spoke to them?
Yeah, you know what you find is a lot of people want to be novelists, and that involves a lot of grammar. And in theater, you're basically writing a lot of dialogue, which you'll put into the context of how people actually speak. And you can actually, you find that people feel the desire to tell stories more like they hear their life, instead of, you know, a lot of the winds were blowing from the north. As you know, this is more like lights rise, I'm in the living room.
Action,
yeah. So, I mean, it's really exciting to see the stories that they tell, and we're getting a whole wide range of concepts and stories from the students.
How does the interest in a class like this relate maybe to the local theater scene and how it's changed?
Well, I can tell you this. When I started writing plays in about 92 in Kansas City, there were like 3 playwrights in town. And then now you have like 85 playwrights getting produced, and there's all sorts of venues, and people are doing like local independent productions, and the audiences are there to come and see them. But the Living Room Theater is focused all on local playwrights, and they do new work. And that's given a home for a lot of people just starting to write plays to actually have professional actors do their work, people that you would see.
It seems like that's how you would have to figure out if your writing worked or not, is with an actor who's doing it justice.
Well, yeah,
and
exactly.
And then you know where the flaws are if the actors are doing a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, with theater, I mean, you have a script, and then it's not like just to be read like a novel, like we said before, but the actors actually give it a life. And when you actually hear it brought to life by people who actually can read a script well. In our class, we have a lot of people reading. We share, you know, the class will each read each other's plays, little pieces of it. And when they hear the reading on stage, it's going to amaze them. The difference of just when we're reading it together versus when you have professional actors reading it.
So tell me about this idea to have all of these students write 10-minute plays, because I feel like, you know, that old saying, I would have written a shorter letter, but I ran out of time or whatever.
Right.
Like, that is, in some ways, to me, that is a more skillful pursuit than open-ended, just go as long as you need to get this story told.
Right, yeah, because you have like 10 pages basically to get an entire arc of a story told. And so they're basically writing mini plays, which is, it's a good process. It's I think, the hardest form of theater to do. But it's also the quickest form that we can actually develop in class and still make changes. Because in the Playwriting 2 class, they'll have full-length plays, and it takes, you can't just read those in class all day, you know. So, but with the 10-minute plays, we can go through 6 plays in a class and learn from it and develop it. But it's really interesting because it's a real politically charged time right now. And to see them come into, in our class, what I've strived to do is to show people that they can write whatever they want. Whatever it is you feel, let it all out. But if you're going to write something politically, we want to see it have both sides get equal time, so to speak.
Why do you want to see that?
Because that helps get your point across and makes it less of an agenda-driven play. If you're going to do a play, just conservative versus liberal, let's just use that generic term. Well, if you're on the liberal side as a writer, you want to make the conservative side's arguments as strong as humanly possible. So if you can show, you know, maybe you can get your point across in a way that actually shows defeating of something intelligent rather than half your audience turning it off because they have better arguments than you.
So you, like, two people who have the same opinion talking about those opinions in the kitchen doesn't cut it?
Not anymore. It's not as good of a theater. You need that conflict, but the conflict should be solid and good and built upon something, you know, that you can actually, you know, develop and have it be interesting.
So tell me a little bit about what you can pull off in a 10-minute play and what you probably shouldn't try to pull off in a 10-minute play.
Well, in a 10-minute play, it's good to have small amounts of characters. Just a couple of characters, maybe 3 at the most. You should avoid massive set changes, massive locations. It's good just to hit a topic, a story, a moment in time, and have that not transgress over like years. Like you won't have a play that like the first half of it is 4 years later or whatever, you know. It's good to have it just be a continual moment in time.
But this advice has applied to plays of all lengths. This goes back to like Aristotle and the Unities.
Well, yeah, you could, and the Poetics, you can get into all that. What you know, it's good to have it that way, but you'll find some of the best plays today have a cinematic quality to them in full length. It's not uncommon now to see like a scene with 25 scenes with 18 locations, because now where it used to always take place in a living room or a kitchen, now you can just put up slide projectors and show different locations without even having to build sets.
Yeah, you can make it happen.
Yeah. And in a 10-minute play, it's good to focus on the dialogue and the action.
So can you tell me about one of these plays? I don't want to spoil anything, and I know a 10-minute play, like, it would be hard to not share too much, but I am curious about, like, where people have gone with this.
Well, what you'll find is people write what they know. And when you get a large group of people, in this class was a smaller class, so we have about 6 or 7, but you have, you know, gay, straight, older, younger, men, women. And there was one play that actually, this will be a good example because it's probably not the one that's going to be in the reading. But we had this one writer and he wrote a play that took place in a laundromat with a transgender female, a male and a female. And At no point in the play did the transgender become an issue or a topic or mentioned. And the whole point of this play was to show this interaction with people in a peaceful, loving environment where nothing was noticed. And all the comments were, well, why was that person transgender? It was like, because that's what it was.
Yeah, like, why was this character straight?
Right. And it was just the subtlety of his writing to put this thing together. I mean, it was just brilliant. And
so and in a way, like, prompting people to ask that question and then ask about why they asked that question.
That is a great – I'm glad you brought that up. We talk about how a playwright's job is never to answer a question. It's to ask the question. And a lot of these plays, you'll find they'll leave you talking about it afterwards. I've always said the worst thing anyone could say about one of my plays afterwards is, what do you want for dinner? You want them talking and arguing all the way home in the car about what they just saw. You know, and a lot of these 10-minute plays will give you that opportunity. And there's going to be a talk back after where the audience can help give them some feedback. And it's going to be a lot of fun because you're going to see, I guarantee some of these writers will be people we'll see produce locally in professional theaters.
So this group of people, I mean, you were just describing the kind of representation in the group just as far as people coming from all kinds of different backgrounds. What has it been like to just be in a room together sharing and sort of embodying each other's stories?
Well, and see, that's the most beautiful part about the class, because we share everything we're doing. And so if you and I brought in our plays to the class, you would see things in my play that I didn't see. And the other person's going to give us notes. We all give notes to each other. We talk about the positive things, things we could work on. And then I usually kind of try and fine-tune some of the different issues in the play. And you're getting a true representation of your audience base, what they are perceiving about what you've written. And it's very easy to become arrogant as a writer and just be of the mind of, yeah, well, I wrote it and they can deal with it, whatever it's going to be, you know. But it's very wonderful to have this impact where I never thought of that. How other people are affected by what you wrote, the insight that they will bring. And you end up with a bunch of these different cultures of different people coming together, building your script with you. And it's really a beautiful kind of thing. And when the classes are over, we're kind of upset, you know, because we've built this cool little bond, especially in the Playwriting 1 class, because it's smaller and we tend to do more work from scratch. And, you know, these people, you should, and the last day, we're very sad, but we're very excited for the readings to come up.
So back to the 10-minute plays. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about just one more?
Okay. One play that sticks out in my mind that will, well, one of them's a film noir style, which is really interesting, and it's very lighthearted and funny. You'll get a kick in all the way to this romance story that takes place in a restroom.
In a restroom?
Yeah, it deals with romance and a job interview. But, you know, the writer's smart enough to put it together and create this wonderful location is important where the play takes place. Things that happen out of, you know, where you wouldn't expect. And I mean, it's hard, like you said. I mean, I could tell you about the play, but it'd give everything away. It's like, but it's, they're very fun. Here's the best thing you can say about 10-minute plays in a reading format where they're all together. If you don't like one, it's not going to last long. And there'll be another one right after it. And that's what's so beautiful about those 10-minute plays when you have a festival of them or a night of them.
You're it's just satisfying the binge-watching.
It's like Netflix. If Netflix was all 10-minute shows, you could just watch them all in one night.
Well, so you are clearly just really passionate about theater, but it seems like you're passionate about it not in some people express their passion in this, like, it was critically acclaimed or whatever. And you're talking more about just the way people are connecting around the theater.
Well, I think as a writer, when you start getting into the more like living off the productions, you tend to become very interested in reviews and whatnot. And I've done that and I've been through that. And when you've had shows like in different cities. I remember I would be excited when I was in Chicago with one of my plays to find that they laughed at the same line as they did in New York. And you felt this weird kind of connection with it. But then after a while, you forget about the roots of what made you start. And this has got me revitalized because suddenly being around a bunch of people who remind me of where I was when I started writing and to have that energy again.
And just that drive to do it.
Yeah, because the success now is based on completion of a project and being proud of it at this stage rather than what were the ticket sales, what's the box office gross, and what they say about you in the paper, you know.
So if you were to take some lesson from the experience of writing 10-minute plays with Kansas Cityans from all different backgrounds over many, many times through now, this introduction to playwriting course, what would the lesson be just for a person, not about playwriting necessarily?
Well, it would definitely be that the team mentality is very important, that we're stronger together than we are separate. And as a writing community, writers are kind of like in football, like a kicker. We're kind of thrown away to the side. We're not often wanted at rehearsals. We're, you know, because we have our own opinions and it's theirs now. And it's nice to have that camaraderie with people who see what you see, have the same visions as you, but they're bringing an entirely different world to it. And you kind of grow. I've become a better person through that class. And I've become a better writer teaching Playwriting 1 than I was before, because I learn, they learn, and it's a group effort.
And then there is a playwriting too.
Yes. And that's a whole different kind of thing, because it's a longer structure of a play. But these Playwriting ones that will be read on the 18th, I believe, it's where everything starts, and it's really going to be exciting to see.
You really aren't production-oriented. You were just like, I think it's on the 18th.
Well, it is on the 18th, that much I know. I'm not a real production-oriented kind of person.
Thank you so much, Ron Simonian. It has been a lot of fun talking to you.
Nice to meet you, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
You can check out the 10-minute plays we just discussed at the Living Room on March 18th. Affirmative March 18th. There's more information online at thelivingroomkc.com. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Central Standard will be right back with Ingrid Stolzel. She's a local composer. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm joined by Ingrid Stolzel, a composer who teaches at KU. Her classical compositions have been performed in concert halls all over the world, and she's just released a new album. In case you think classical music is this hard-to-get genre that you have to be trained to appreciate, just hold up, because Ingrid's goal as a composer is actually not some complex idea just for classically trained audiences. Her goal is goosebumps. Ingrid, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to me about goosebumps.
Well, it's such an amazing thing we can experience when we're listening to music. It's just a physical reaction to what we're experiencing. And I remember it as a child so vividly. Just even right now, I can think of a piece of music and make myself get goosebumps. And it's a phenomenal thing.
I want to talk to you about your new album and play some clips for our listeners. But first, right, I do want to talk about you. Did you grow up in a musical family?
I did. I grew up in Germany, and my father was a singer. We had a music room in the house, and so I started playing an instrument early on and just was surrounded
what
by
instrument?
Music. I played piano. Yeah.
That seems like a natural start for a composer, maybe because it's melodic.
It is. It's actually all of it. It's melodic, it's harmonic, it has the range of an orchestra. So to this day, I compose at the piano.
When did you start writing music?
I started writing music as a kid, but, you know, I didn't call myself a composer. It was just something that I did for fun.
An unusual child.
Right. I mean, there are some, probably. But for me, it was always difficult to memorize other people's music. And, you know, when you learn piano, you learn Mozart and Haydn and all of those composers. And I would always sort of improvise different endings to pieces just because I wasn't very good at memorizing other people's music.
What was the impulse? Can you describe the impulse to just make up your own ending?
I think there was something just creative about it. And sometimes the music, I felt like, not that I think I'm better than Mozart, but I wanted it to go somewhere else. And so I let myself just almost like just improvise at the piano. And that's still a way for me to find inspiration today. Just let myself kind of be inside the sound world and see where it wants to go.
And like your fingers just know where to go on the keyboard?
Yeah, although I should say, you know, I'm not a pianist anymore because I just spend more time composing than I do playing the piano.
Your new album is actually your first commercial album, and it's called The Gorgeous Nothings. The first few songs are inspired by, do I understand this right, scraps of paper that Emily Dickinson left behind?
Yeah, so there's an amazing book out, a facsimile edition called The Gorgeous Nothings, and it's envelope writings. She, at times, she just grabbed whatever she could find, and often it was envelopes, and she would write down thoughts. They're not really completed poems per se. They're fragments. And really, it was quite inspiring also looking at the poems and her handwriting. And often she would have multiple words that she hadn't decided which one she was going to go for. And so that really helped me in my creative process as well.
What did you like about that? I mean, was it the idea of just getting inside someone else's creative process?
Absolutely. Because if you look at my sketches and my notes that I put on staff paper, I cross things out, I write different variations on something. I often have 10 different endings to a piece of music. And so it gives somebody a little bit of insight of what, you know, what was going on for Emily Dickinson. And it gave me, I think, a bit more freedom in interpreting her words, because these are not published poems, they're fragments.
We talked a while back about what it's like to be a woman in classical music today, specifically a composer creating new works in that arena. And I wonder if some of the challenges, but also triumphs you've had in that world, connect you in a weird way to this 19th century female poet, the experience of being a woman with something to say, with an impulse for creative expression.
Absolutely. And I think Emily Dickinson is, her words today to me are so contemporary. It doesn't feel like I'm reading something that was written, you know, 100 years ago. And to me, that is, I think, ultimately the goal of great art, is that it really surpasses our own time, that we can read something or listen to something and it still makes sense.
Let's listen to some of this music. We're going to start with a short one called In This Short Life. What's the Emily Dickinson envelope or scrap that inspired this one?
Yeah, this is actually, she wrote this very short fragment on the flap of an envelope. And I'll let the singer tell you the words, but the shape of it, and it just felt really urgent and also very concise. So I also, in my...
What felt urgent about it? Was it the handwriting or something?
The handwriting, and also, you know, just, it felt like she grabbed this little flap of an envelope and couldn't wait to get to her notebook. It had to be written down at that moment.
All right, here is In This Short Life.
In this short life that only lasts an hour, in this short life,
Tell me about that song, Ingrid.
Wow, I just love her words. In this short life that only lasts an hour, how much, how little is within our power. And she actually gives two words in the beginning. She kind of has them written on the envelope flap above each other. It's only and merely. I know they're synonyms, really, but I decided to use them both. So I repeat that first line twice. And I just, it's, the words are powerful, and I wanted to also have a very concise, short song that kind of expresses that. And this, you heard, I would believe many of your listeners know this voice, Sarah Tannehill Anderson, one of our wonderful Kansas City sopranos, and she just so captures that with her voice.
What is it about those lines, about how little is within our power, that resonates with you?
Yeah, so I said those words sort of reflectively at the end. So it has this big moment, how much, how little, and then is within our power. To me, it's really that we don't have any power, and we should, you know, be in the moment and enjoy that hour that we have.
Tell me about your process. Do you have like a routine or set of rituals that allow you to immerse yourself in this, what you called a world of sound, but it's also a world of language?
It is. And I, on this CD, I have two song cycles, and those are, of course, you know, the words are the most important, and I immerse myself in those words. But even the other pieces, the other chamber pieces, start really with a title and an emotional sound world I'm trying to create. And that is what really kind of every day I get to enter that sound world. It's like a best friend, honestly. When I'm working on a piece of music, it's like coming home and getting to be with a best friend for a while.
We're going to hear another song now. This one is based on Walt Whitman. So first of all, why Walt Whitman?
Yeah, so I'm sure many Americans come across Walt Whitman much earlier in their lives, maybe even high school, I don't know. But for me, because I grew up in Germany, I read Rilke and Goethe. And so I come to these American greats like Dickinson and Whitman much later in life. And I read Leaves of Grass, which is just mind-blowingly amazing. And I picked three poems to create a song cycle, which I call Soul Journey 3.
But before we talk about your songs, I am so curious about someone with a German background who's coming to Walt Whitman as an adult, and as an adult living in America, what spoke to you?
I think, again, it's these contemporary ideas that we, you know, that life's a journey, and that we really need to be in the moment. And when I write music, I feel like music has that ability to move us to really, sometimes we lose track of time when we listen to music. It's really quite extraordinary.
So this song is called I Swear I Think. What is the original poem or line that inspired it?
Yeah, so this is from Leaves of Grass, and this is the second song in the cycle. And when I put a song cycle together, I try to create a larger narrative. So not each song is just its own thing, but that the three songs in the cycle create a journey. And the first song is sort of this, the poet realizing there is a thing that's grander than just what we see. And the second song, which you're going to play, I Swear I Think, it's quite joyful and playful, where the poet basically realizes, wow, everything has a soul. So he talks about the animals and the sea and the weeds, and so that everything is connected and alive. And yeah, so that's what I'm trying to capture in this playful song.
Well, here's Ingrid Stolzel's I Swear I Think.
I swear I think now that everything without exception has an eternal soul.
So, yeah, this is very playful. The idea that what you're trying to capture here is the idea that everything has a soul?
Yeah, and he says, you know, Whitman says that there is nothing but immortality. That in some way, shape, or form, you know, everything continues as energy. And to me, that's a very contemporary way of thinking about life.
What is it about the sound of the song that captures that?
To me, it's a celebratory, uplifting kind of song, and the part that we're hearing right now is, yeah, playful. And when we, I think, go through life like that, thinking and looking at things as if they're all connected, we have a certain joy, I believe.
And you said this is part of a three-song cycle, and this is so first it's realizing that life is grander than it maybe seems on the surface, and then the next is realizing that everything is interconnected and that you can enjoy it.
Yeah.
What's third?
So third is the end of life. And this is written later in Whitman's life. And it's clear that he is older when he writes it. And yet, you know, it's in the same spirit where he feels there is, you know, the soul has been with us all along. And even though we go into this unknown now.
Classical music has this reputation for being stuffy or snobby. You might have heard this reputation before. But you seem to be actively working to change that perception. Do you find that to be an uphill battle?
Sometimes. And also, you know, programming, people generally program the known pieces. It's possibly a risk for them to program something new. But whenever I go to a contemporary art museum or like the MoMA in New York, there's lines out the door, people wanting to see contemporary art and things that are created in our time. I feel like it's the same with music. It speaks in a way to our time. And if we're lucky, it will transcend our time like many amazing pieces have done in the past. But for sure, music being written today has something to say about today. And that's important to me.
So for venues, there's the risk of putting on something that isn't recognizable to the audiences. How do you get the audiences to show up who aren't maybe part of that, you know, entrenched classical music world? Like maybe they would like this new sound you're presenting, but how do you let them know that?
Yeah, I go to a lot of concerts and I find actually the personal touch of having the composer there. So it's not this just completely removed or dead white guy. You know, there's no connection anymore. When they meet a composer or audiences and after the performance can come up and ask questions, I think it breaks down that barrier that it's, you know, something unapproachable.
The name of this album, Gorgeous Nothings, you've said I mean, I'm curious to hear you talk about what that means to you, Gorgeous Nothings.
Yeah, so you know, I stole it from Emily Dickinson, and it's in the first song of the Gorgeous Nothings. And for her, the way she thinks of those words together is that everything, like a sunset, the wheels of birds, you know, the seasons, all of that, these are things that happen all the time. They're nothings, but they're gorgeous, and they make up life. It's even though, you know, life has big moments that we might remember, it's the collection of little things that really makes a life.
What makes them nothing, though? I mean, I think maybe it's this that all of the things you've described are really fleeting.
Yeah, perhaps. I think and the idea of impermanence, you know, that nothing really remains the same. I think throughout the album, I have a theme of that.
That could be such a somber idea, but for you, it seems to be uplifting and inspiring. Can you talk about where that just attitude comes from within your life, within your day-to-day approach to things?
Yeah, I mean, I have a meditative practice, and I think that certainly has influenced my writing. And I think my goal as a composer is to put love and joy out there. I'm aware of the things that are going on, of course, in the world, but what's most authentic to me is to put something out there that is uplifting. And that's how I also, you know, when you write a piece of music, you live in that world for a long time. So I'm sort of selfishly picking a joyful, peaceful, loving sound world for myself.
What would be the just biggest, most meaningful compliment you could possibly receive from a listener?
For me, it's that they were moved by something I've done. And if they're so willing to share that, I think that's really touching.
Ingrid Stolzel is an associate professor of music composition at KU. We spoke to her back in August when her most recent album was released. It's called The Gorgeous Nothings, if you want to check it out. That's it for today's show. You can listen back to anything we talked about today or ever at kcur.org/centralstandard. While you're there, you can also sign up to just have these shows sent to you on your phone, kind of like a podcast, so you never have to miss out on a really good conversation. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, what is it like to document issues of race in Kansas City in 2019? Local reporters following that beat will talk to us about it tomorrow at 10. We hope you'll tune in to hear their perspectives, and you can share yours on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Start talking now. Race from the vantage point of Kansas City. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.